For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Last week and the week before, we saw this verse in Romans 1:19. That which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So you should be able to look inside of yourself and see something. It's within you. Something in there should suggest that God is real. Talking to a student a little while back, he's like, I've never seen anything supernatural in my whole life. Never seen a miracle, never seen anything other than you. I'm like, oh, actually you have. You see it a lot, every day in fact. And we're referring to your soul, the existence of a soul. A soul, non-material, we're not using wordplay to, you know, describe just the physical here. This is really a non-material entity, able to think, able to feel. It survives the death of your body. That's definitely supernatural. Able to think rationally, that's pretty important. We wouldn't be able to think rationally if we didn't have a soul that was independent of the body. We'll see why in a minute. Able to make free choices, also really important. And wouldn't be possible if ourselves are just physical bodies. There has to be a non-material soul in order to make the idea of free choice even conceivable. And of course, since we can choose and reason, we become morally competent, able to do moral and immoral things, and also culpable in a way no other animal would be, only us. Cool thing about a soul or a spirit, and I'm conflating those two. They're sometimes used separately, but we're not going to get, that's another discussion. We'll just work with them together. Able to relate to God and to be joined to God's spirit. Like it says in 1 Corinthians 6, the one who joins himself with the Lord is one spirit with him. Our spirit and God's spirit actually fuse together, and we become united at a deep spiritual level with God if we want that. And that's what we were designed to be. If we're having problems in our lives, a lot of times the reason is we don't have that union with God. That's what's missing right there. You know, the basis, the reason where we got souls is explained to us in Genesis 1:27. So God created human beings in his image. In the image of God, he created them. He created them male and female. Well, to be created in the image of God, it doesn't mean that we look like God. It means that we share certain key characteristics that have to do with personhood, that have to do with high order relating, relatability. And God says he bestowed that on humans. In Hebrews, it says, since we had human fathers who disciplined us and we respected them for it, how much more should we submit to the Father of spirits and live? So apparently we have a human father for the biological part, and then God is called the Father of spirits. He apparently imbues this soul, this spirit, into every person sometime before birth, because we come out already with it. And it is before birth. We're not sure when. Proof of that is that John the Baptist was filled with the Holy Spirit while still in his mother's womb. Well, we want to look at multiple lines of evidence tonight that this soul thing is real, and both scientifically and in other ways, that we really do have souls, and we can sense that. Our sense, most people intuitively sense this anyway, that I have a body, but I'm in here, I'm me, I'm separate from that. It turns out that intuition is correct. We want to look at high-order consciousness, and also near-death experiences, other indications of free will, which we have several, arguments from physics. A lot of these are recent evidence coming to light. Then, two, the discrediting parts of the no-soul view, which is frankly pretty weak, And we hope to show that. New evidence from showing the power of mind over matter involved in neuroscience is showing this, yeah. Let's start with high order consciousness. We're not just talking here about simple awareness, like you wake up from sleep and you become aware of the room you're in, so you're conscious, so, as opposed to unconscious. That's that is like a rudimentary aspect of consciousness. We're talking about high order. We're probably no different than the animals when it comes to basic awareness of our surroundings. And it's interesting that in the literature on this, with people that are kind of attacking the idea of the soul, they always absolutely limit themselves to rudimentary sensations like seeing the color red or something like that, which is really not the point at all. It's high order consciousness is the point. For instance, second order thought, where I'm thinking about my thoughts, where I could be pondering a line of thinking for days, for weeks, building on what I thought before, adding more evidence and so on. Boy, we're all alone on that. No one else doing that. Able to think about abstract things like math, relationships between cause and effect in a system, or that which is true. Wonder what's true here, what's false. We're all alone on all of those kind of things. When we get into animal intelligence, they can reason well with physical objects. And they're actually, some of them are pretty decent on that. But abstraction, never. Never. Thinking that transcends the tangible and the material. Yeah, I saw one show about a chimp where they would hold up a panel, had a panel of keys with symbols on that were fairly elaborate, like a Japanese characters or something like that. And a screen would come up with five of them across, and he could pick out five faster than any human could ever do it, two, three times faster. So really smart when it came to spatial and material objects like that. But abstraction, yeah, totally different. Awareness of the self in history, not just that I'm here dodging something that's being thrown at me, self in that sense, but rather that I am me, I've been me for a long time. I can think back to when I was five, I can think of things that happened back then. It was me that was there then. I'm still here. You weren't there. I was there. And I realize that I'm heading somewhere too, and I'm basically anticipating and laying plans and developing. A lot of you are going to college right now. That's anticipating. You're going to go through years of trouble and difficulty for the sake of a future goal. That is uniquely high order consciousness. Think about the mind's eye. What a cool thing. Right in our mind, we can visualize things that happened, remembering things that happened, or visualizing things that never did happen, things that we just create out of nothing. I wrote a couple of novels, and it was so cool to just spend a whole day in an imaginary world, and you would see the action, the players that you were imagining, and you felt like you were in that world. Yeah, mind's eye, totally sweet. Symbolic language, oh man, this is a huge area. The capability for language. Let's take a little bit of time on this. To bark, screech, howl out of, you know, some stimulus, anger, fear, longing for a mate, whatever. Totally different than what we're talking about here. When we get into high-order language capability, we are all alone again. And there's been some remarkable finds in this area. We can encode our ideas into sounds, like I'm doing right now, and those are decoded with high level of accuracy by the receivers. Or we can mark down shapes on paper or on a screen and turn those into words. If somebody can't see to read that, they can learn to do it with their fingers, with Braille. It's amazing. Even blind children who were never taught to sign, never taught sign language, developed their own with syntax and hierarchy, all of the marks of language, Which goes to show it's not the language that's leading to the brilliance, it's the brilliance that's leading to the language. Mark Baker is a professor of linguistics on the East Coast, an expert in language, and his article, Brains and the Souls, Grammar and Speaking, he is a non-materialist scholar. He thinks that the best explanation is that there is a soul, after all. He points out that Noam Chomsky, who's kind of the father of modern linguistics, divided language into three components. First of all, is the lexicon. That's your list of words, which, you know, for a typical educated person in the English-speaking world is probably 50,000 word range. The apes, great apes, can also get a lexicon going, and they're limited to about 300 to 600 words, but that's significant. Second, though, there's the grammar, the controller part, which defines how to arrange words and which how to modify the endings and spellings of words for the part of speech that it fits. So I throw the ball, I threw the ball, those are not the same. And we do this on the fly very, very quickly, matching appropriate parts of speech. The third thing, though, is really far out, what he eventually came to call the creative aspect of language use, or the CALU for short. So if you were building a building, okay, your lexicon would be your brick, your lumber, your steel that's piled up on the site, ready to go, concrete. The controller, the grammar part, would be the builders that come out with the know-how. They know how to assemble these things. They're ready to build. Something's missing. What are we going to build? Right? We need directions. And that's like the architect. It says we're going to have the walls are going to be here, the footers are going to be there, and so forth. We're going with concrete on this and steel on that and so on. Instructions. And then the others can carry it out. This is the way language works, this creative aspect. Completely missing in any animal, arguably, and Derek Anderson argues that animals don't even have the second one, that they cannot understand syntax, that they've never been able to get further than two words, like Lucy, banana, which humans reach that stage at about 2 years old. But then just continue to soar upward. Here's a couple of really interesting things about this. Chomsky correctly observed that human capacity for language must consist of more than a lexicon and grammar. It also includes the ability to choose which words to use and assemble them in ways that are consistent with the grammar to make actual sentences. Human language has the following three properties. It's unbounded, which means I can say whatever I want. There's no limitations. I'm not limited in the number of choices I can do. I can take limited number of letters, 26 in our case, make up an infinite number of words, and take these words and make an infinite number of sentences and meanings. I mean, there is literally no bound to it at all. Secondly, it's stimulus-free. In programming a computer, you know, you tell it if this, then that. And so the computer has to have stimulation or can respond to what comes into it. Human language is not that way. I'm not having buttons pushed to make me say what I want. I basically have a completely free range, and I can take initiative and I don't need to be stimulated. I can come up with my own stuff. And also that it's appropriate to the situation and matches the situation. They found that no animal had these behaviors and or any automaton. No computer system is able to do it either. Now, he says, higher animals sometimes show a degree of creativity when it comes to tasks like navigating through a complex environment, a maze, let's say, adopting foraging strategies, or manipulating fellow members of the species. But we see no such thing when it comes to the ability we have to create sentences freely and purposely. That's just something the great apes cannot do. And interestingly, in neuroscience, they spend a lot of time studying lesions in the brain and brain injury and how that affects different capabilities that you have. That's a huge part of how we map what different parts of the brain accomplish which tasks. And this neuroscience has studied language now for a long time and has made a lot of interesting contributions, as he says, significant contributions to the theory of vocabulary and also to the grammar, the lexicon and the controller. They can know the areas of the brain that where those reside. And if that area is damaged, you will think a word and you won't be able to summon it. Or you can't put the words together intelligibly. But astonishingly little evidence that they contribute to anything to the creative aspect of language usage. We can't find a place in the brain where that resides. He thinks we're justified to think that this creative aspect is a function of the soul more than the body. They also studied brain lesions and also genetic damage and defect, which results in shortcomings in various areas. And they can, again, find the genes that code for the hearing and lexicon and the control areas, the syntax areas, but they can find no place that corresponds to this creative aspect. After 140 years of neurological research, then there is no evidence that this creative aspect depends on dedicated brain tissue. There's no place in the brain that contains it. The creative aspect seems not to be directly dependent on the brain in the way that other interactive functions like vocabulary and grammar are. Wow, that's interesting. That's really interesting. That makes some sense, too, when you watch people converse and so forth. It really doesn't look very determined what's going on there. It looks quite free and flows naturally and easily. Symbolic language, powerful evidence of something way above animal life. Then there's other areas of artistic creation and appreciation. You just think of how much time people spend in music, listening to it, making it. It's a big part of every day for most of us. And no one else has it. We say, well, wait, you know, birds sing, and you can identify birds by their song. You know, the same goes with other animals. They have a small collection of cries, songs. It's not music. It's not what we consider music. Where, again, that creative aspect that's unbounded, that is capable of anything, everything, totally far out. Of course, if it's not music or cinema, or the fine arts, you know, we're crazy about it. Here in the West, we love it. In the East, they love it. Everywhere, they love it, no matter where we go. Primitive villages that never saw electricity. They're all over the art, carvings and paintings and so forth. That is uniquely human, and it really suggests it's not really, you know, it's really hard to see how spending so much time on something like this, an investment, is enhancing our survival. You say, well, it makes it so you can be social. Not really. I mean, most of my time listening to music is by myself. I prefer it that way. Actually, other animals are totally social and they don't have music. So, I mean, I don't think that's a very good explanation. Ability to analyze and draw rational inference, the ability to think rationally and to arrive at conclusions as a part of high-order consciousness. You have to be able to weigh alternatives, judging the relative validity of different arguments, recognizing the true cause from the spurious cause, and so forth. All of these require unfettered freedom. If you're not free in what you're thinking and analyzing, then you wouldn't really be thinking. You would simply be being driven by a chemical electrical process, sort of like, if you apply heat to a pot of water, it boils, right? That's physics. The water didn't decide to boil, didn't think, okay. It boils because it's a physical machine of cause and effect. Well, the thinking of humans is unfettered and free. We compared our intellect to lions, for instance. Lions are pretty high up. They're social. They hunt. They do pack hunting, which requires that they set ambushes. So they drive the gazelle into waiting partners who make the kill. That's pretty advanced, okay? But when the wildebeest start their 1,500-mile migration pattern, you see the lion sitting on the hill watching the wildebeest walk off. And for the next 6 months, many lions will die from starvation. This is when the weaker don't make it. The solution to their problem is right there. Why don't we follow? Maybe we should follow the wildebeest. They can't do it. They're territorial. And so there's this hardwired, rigid, fixed aspect to the intellect there. And you see that in animal behavior. Elements of creativity, but it's within a pretty strict framework. And there is we got to call it instinct, which is different than unfettered thought. Now, anyone who accepts physicalism or materialism, the belief that all there is just matter, energy, and the laws of physics, has to also accept determinism. That means everything that happens, just like, you know, you heat the water and it boils, there are other sequences of cause and effect, some of them way more complicated, but it's still the same thing. You know, that's what we've learned, how the physical world works. The question before us is there anything other than the physical world? Well, if your answer is no, then you have to accept determinism. There's no way to avoid determinism under materialistic thinking. But when we watch human behavior, it doesn't seem like it is determined. That determined creatures or systems have kind of a stiffness and a predictability that's not found in humans. To my eye, that's the way it looks. When I watch humans, they're super unpredictable. You know, some of us are creatures of habit. We like to do certain things over, but yeah, really hard to predict what humans are going to do. We'll think a little bit more about that freedom issue in a minute. Morality. To understanding that some things are right and some things are wrong. Some things are just wrong. And as much as people will try to resist it, it's really ultimately a universal consensus. People will say, well, I don't believe there's such a thing as right and wrong, and then you'll find them not too much later making moral statements. Our justice system assumes this. We hold people responsible. If there's no such thing as morality, we have no business punishing people and putting them in prison. We can't live without it. If you try to be amoral, you're just unable. And it's exclusively human. Exclusively human. We all know that. Whatever the lion kills, even if it's another lion, we don't have a trial and send him to prison. It's not immoral. He's just being a lion. That's what they are. They're an animal. We know obviously that this is only humans that are responsible for this. Why not animals? It's because they lack the high order consciousness necessary. This is why. Derek Penn and a group of six other animal intelligence scholars wrote this article about Darwin's mistake, explaining the discontinuity between human and non-human minds. You can download this article for free online. To sum up their case, they go through 20 different areas, and they said, they conclude the functional discontinuity between humans and non-human minds pervades nearly every domain of cognition. And it's just day and night. No similarity, no closeness. And, you know, there's a lot of people that don't want to hear that, including the authors. The authors here are all agnostic, atheistic. They said, we're completely committed to materialistic evolution, but let's face it, there's an issue here, and there is a huge disparity, massive disparity. Michael Gazzaniga is, again, an atheist professor, wrote his book on Who's in Charge, Free Will and the Science of the Brain. Can brains have free will? He's shocked that some people can't see the massive discontinuity between humans and other animals. And he gave an interesting example, which was the second most, in the view of most brain scientists, the second most intelligent species on Earth are chimpanzees. Humans and then chimpanzees. Humans, he pointed out, live in every environment on Earth, from the Arctic to jungles, deserts, mountains, anywhere you go, and humans have colonized and they're living there. The second most brilliant animal on Earth is near extinction because they can't adapt to the loss of habitat in their area. Boy, is that ever a huge difference. I remember watching a Jane Goodall special. You know, she's all about the chimps, and discovered them using tools and using a stick to pull ants out of the anthill. And, you know, they were just like the narrators were just like, this is it. The tool makers, we used to arrogantly think we were different, but, you know, it's like, this is basically, it's the same thing. I mean, just a difference in quantity, really the same thing. And, you know, you're like, I'm flying on an airplane right now watching this on my laptop. You know, are your powers of observation that weak, or is it just you don't want to face the facts here? Oh, man, this is what we really have. We could have an intellect graft, and we'd have to have over 2 million species. Nobody knows how many species there are because we discover about 10,000 a year. But it's definitely in the millions. And arranged from the most intelligent down to the amoeba or whatever is the weakest link there. And so there's millions of species on this graph, not just the ones I show. All the way up and down that, the difference between any two lines would be microscopic, would be negligible, would be so similar that even experts would disagree on which was more intelligent. And then all of a sudden, wham, human intelligence shows up. And probably the disparity is even much worse than what I'm showing here. Think about that. Wow. Wait a minute. Where are the intervening? Where are the intervening species? Where are the humanoids that are kind of like half as intelligent? They don't exist anywhere we go in the world. Up into an isolated valley in New Guinea, the intelligence of humans is the same everywhere you go. And, when you think about it, there is no major capability gap like this anywhere in nature. Whether it's eyesight, ability to see, you know, we're decent. We see color. We're better than dogs in that regard. Nothing like a raptor. That can see way better than us. Speed. You know, humans can run 20 miles an hour. So. Nowhere near what a jaguar can do or a cheetah, let alone a falcon. But here's the thing. All the way down, from the falcon down, there's going to be examples all the way up and down there. Some people are like, well, there's special categories like luminescence, you know, bioluminescence. No, lots of creatures have bioluminescence. Again, that would be the same type of spread. None of them would have something like this. This is absolutely unique in nature. Oh, man, does that cry out for an explanation? It really doesn't fit the pure Darwinian picture very well. You shouldn't see giant gaps like that. High order consciousness. Boom. Yes. Now, near-death experiences. Here we have people claiming that they felt themselves leaving their bodies and looked down and saw their bodies while they were out dead on the table, on an operating table. and their heart and even brain waves ceased to function. Then they were revived, came back, and they come back telling these stories. By now, it's a little ambiguous in my mind because of the fact that it's anecdotal. It's based on people's testimony. However, the database is exploding on this into the thousands of cases because of our enhanced ability to bring people back who become technically dead. And they're coming back with these stories over and over again. It's starting to make me wonder whether we shouldn't give a little bit more attention to this. It flatly contradicts the materialistic story, right? Because here you still have a person, they're out, they lose consciousness, and all of a sudden they come back to consciousness and find themselves looking down at their body, which is now dead. And the far out thing is then they hear and see things going on in the operating room while they were out cold under anesthesia and even technically dead. Often multiple witnesses who, as they can recount a conversation, the people involved were like, that's exactly what we were talking about. Could they be hallucinations? Could they be dreams? Probably not. If you've ever been anesthetized, you know that the last thing you remember is the thing coming down. And the next thing you remember is coming out of it. And you don't dream. You are totally dormant mentally when you're anesthetized. These guys are coming back with these stories. It's pretty suggestive. Patrick Glynn is a Harvard PhD, an agnostic who changed his mind and became a theist, in part because of fine-tuning, which we studied a couple weeks ago, in part because of this. He thinks there's something here. He's now a professor of physics at Georgetown. He reports on the studies done by Dr. Michael Sabom, who is a surgeon, also an agnostic, but heard these stories and started going out and collecting samples. He tells about a 52-year-old night watchman from rural Florida gave Sabom a detailed account of his open-heart surgery, which he claimed to have observed from a vantage point above the operating table. Sabom was a heart surgeon, and so he asked the guy to write down a sequence of what he saw, and Sabom, who as a surgeon knew what he would be seeing, puts it in his book. You can read them matched up right side by side. The log kept by the operating doctor matches exactly what this guy saw. Whoa. Yeah, so maybe there is a soul afterwards, after all. It must be. I'm not going to spend any more time on that. Let's go to other indications of free will. All right, why do we think that our will is free? We don't think it's totally free. Particularly, I'm speaking as a Bible-believing theist, okay? We believe that our freedom of will has been damaged, compromised by what we call the fall of humanity. And so we don't have complete freedom. We also get caught up in things. Jesus warned that, you know, sin is enslaving. And so if you become an addict, you lose some of your freedom of choice through that and so forth. So it's not absolute, but there is sufficient freedom left that we have culpability. One reason for believing that is just your own intuition. You know, you stand at the subway counter. Am I going to get the subway club? I think I'll change. I think I'll get one of those egg things today. I don't believe. I find it very hard to believe that I'm being somehow determined to do this. It doesn't seem like I'm determined at all. It's very counter-intuitional to claim that I'm not free to that. One of the things that makes us confident, though, that we must have freedom is the success that we have in reasoning. Reasoning requires freedom. Berlinsky, who's a mind philosopher, says mind is like no other property of physical systems. The physicist Eric Harth has reasonably remarked, it's not just that we don't know how the mechanisms that give rise to it. We have difficulty in seeing how any mechanism can give rise to it. True, a mechanistic system cannot bridge the gap over into actual freedom. It just isn't possible. I chose an old object that they used to have these things called watches. And I like this because it's more visual. You can see that the teeth of the wheels in this machine are interlocking. So they don't have any freedom. When one wheel moves, the other wheel moves accordingly. And the whole thing is like that. There's a spring, and it tells time. Okay, it doesn't know what it's doing. In fact, it doesn't know anything, right? It's not thinking. This isn't thinking. And it cannot reason. It can do what it's made to do. And after all, it's because it's a machine. It's just a machine. Now, what we have to see is that under materialism, we are just like that. We're no different than that. And we have no more chance of breaking out of the cause and effect sequence under materialism than that watch would to start deciding, I think I'll do something else other than tell time. C.S. Lewis, a Christian thinker, says, for the theist, the human mind in the act of knowing is set free in the measure required from the huge nexus of non-rational causation, free from this to be determined by the truth known. We're not completely free, but it's sufficient. Yeah, he points out that in machines and in a physical system, things are caused, but that reason is not caused. It actually steps outside of cause to analyze rational inference. Here's Doug Grutas, a professor in philosophy also. In the world, if the world were made only of material things arranged in various causal patterns, that's what materialism teaches, our thoughts would not be exempt from this causal mix. Right, they believe that. They believe that we are not free to think whatever we want. We're completely determined. He says the notion that with our minds can transcend material forces and discover the truth about reality would therefore be unwarranted. When we reason from a premise to a conclusion, we're not thinking in terms of material causes, but rather in terms of rational inference. And the rules of rationality are different than the rules of physics. We literally would not be able to trust any conclusion we reach because they're under determinism, they're being caused by forces and chemistry and physics within the brain. Electrical impulses, neurotransmitters that are completely out of our control. So there's no reason then to think that we are reaching valid conclusions. Yeah, ability to reason. On the other hand, we look out and we can see everywhere validation of the fact that we are reasoning. Think of something like technology. You know, we not only had people walking on the moon, you pull out your phone and just think about all the things it can do. Technology all around us, and it's clear that we're not just, you know, robots reacting, that we are clearly thinking and reason. These are the results of scientific discoveries and innovations that work, and therefore it must be real reasoning that we're doing. If we're really reasoning, then that indicates that we do have free will to some extent. And if we have free will, how would we get free will in a material system? You can't. If we have free will, that points to the non-material self or soul. Because it's non-material, it's not in the grip of the physical cause and effect sequence. It's free from that. Able to think freely. And we have evidence of that all around us, especially in a modern city. Yeah. Reason points to freedom, and that points to the soul. In reading the anti-soul criticism, they really like to focus, as I said earlier, on lesions and the effect of lesions in the brain. And that shows, since you get part of your brain destroyed, and it changes your personality. And therefore, the conclusion is you're not a person, you're a brain. There is no mind and brain. The brain and mind are the same thing. I don't think it proves that. I compare it to driving a car. You know, if you were driving a car and you went down the road and got, you know, two flats, let's say, on the same side, that car would hardly run. You know, it would be weaving and bumping along, totally messed up. It doesn't mean that the driver's not there. It doesn't mean that the driver has something wrong with him. It's the machine that he's riding. And the relation of mind to brain is probably that is between a thinking. The thinking is probably done in the soul. And the brain is a connection point where the soul can receive data and send out instructions. Of course, if your engine blew up, you couldn't drive it at all. Still wouldn't mean that there's no driver there. It's the car that's damaged. The brain. Mind-body dualism, yeah. Moreland reports on Wilder Penfield, a neuroscientist who was working with epileptics and open brain surgery and could stimulate an area in the brain of epileptic patients and found that he could cause them to move their arm or their legs, you know, turn their heads, eyes, talk, or swallow. But invariably, the patient would respond by saying, I didn't do that, you did that. Now think about that a little bit. Under materialism, the brain is all there is. But here, he's causing the brain to elicit certain reactions, but the person's saying, that's not me. Yeah, this is a pretty famous set of experiments we're done. Mario Beauregard is a neuroscientist from Montreal. He says the brain is not the mind. It's an organ suitable for connecting a mind to the rest of the universe. Yeah, I think that's right. I think he's right. From the materialist perspective, our human mind's consciousness and our free will are problems that need to be explained away because they don't fit with the system, not because any evidence has been gathered that says they're not there. All right. I can see this is going to be worse than I thought. We're going to have to skip Penrose. This illustration where people, and we'll skip that too. I really want to do Al-Khalili's two-split experiment where human observation changes the causes of wave collapse in quantum physics. Very powerfully suggestive. Let's talk a little bit about why I think the no-soul, anti-soul thinkers are discredited and not very credible at all. I think it's really inconsistent in the first place to use your mind to claim that you don't have a mind. here's Sam Harris, author of Free Will. He doesn't believe that we have any free will whatsoever.
I'm not arguing that consciousness is a reality beyond science or beyond the brain or that it floats free of the brain at death. I'm not making any spooky claims about its metaphysics. What I am saying, however, is that the self is an illusion, the sense of being an ego, an I, a thinker of thoughts in addition to the thoughts, an experiencer in addition to the experience, that the sense that we all have of riding around inside our heads as a kind of a passenger in the vehicle of the body, that's where most people start when they think about any of these questions. Most people don't feel identical to their bodies. They feel like they have bodies. They feel like they're inside the body. Yeah. And most people feel like they're inside their heads.
Yeah? And you found out that that's an illusion? How did you discover that? So my experience that I'm me is all an illusion. That must have been a powerful discovery when they found that out. Now, there was no discovery. They just assume that. There's nothing backing this up. This is a naked philosophical claim. They're claiming to know things they cannot possibly. How would he know that my sense of self is an illusion? They can't even tell us. Brain science is not even to the point where they can tell you what a thought is. Not even that far. They can't tell us what a belief is or how that works in the brain at all. They're mired down in the details of the chemistry of synapses and so forth, which areas of the brain fire in accordance with different, Thomas Nagel rips him down. he says, I'm reminded of the Marx Brothers line, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? That's basically what Dennett's and the others are claiming. You know, everything you've perceived, everything that everyone throughout history and all cultures and all times has perceived, is all false. It's all illusory. And you know, you feel like, dude, what's your proof? Burden of evidence. This thought: if we can't trust our own senses, how can we know if anything is true? You know, we have to work through our senses, and I think you can sense your own soul very clearly. And if that's an illusion, anything could be an illusion, I think. That's one of our most basic experiences in life. Pinker from Harvard.
I don't believe there's such a thing as free will in the sense of a ghost in the machine, a spirit or soul that somehow reads the TV screen of the senses and pushes buttons and pulls levers of behavior. There's no sense that we can make of that.
Yeah. Again, they don't explain why that is wrong or anything. They just dismiss it like that. We just can't make sense of that. Forget about that. Beauregard points out that one convenient aspect of Pinker's materialism is that any doubt can be labeled unscientific in principle. That preempts any discussion of modern materialism's plausibility. But the strength of their conviction neither shows that it's a correct account of a reality, nor does it provide evidence in its favor. A good case can be made for the opposite view. Well, one of the things that I find very discrediting too is the trying to shift the burden of proof. In no soul, anti-soul thinking, the argument is, well, you have to prove there's a soul. We don't have to prove anything. And it's like, well, if we agree to that kind of dialogue, then obviously we're going to all be no soul theists or theorists. How can you, why do they not have to prove anything and everyone else has to prove anything? I think someone claiming that my experience of myself is an illusion shoulders the full 100% burden of proof. Just as much as if someone was trying to claim my sense of sight is an illusion, or that my sense of hearing is an illusion. It ain't going to be an easy sell. And I don't feel I have to prove that what I see out here is really here. I think you have to prove that it's not there. And really, I feel like the no-soul thesis, which is a tiny sliver of people that believe this in the scope of humanity. Everyone else thinks we do have a soul. And only a small number of Westerners maintain that we don't. No proof is offered. Just dismissal and claims. They're really, as you look for, okay, what are their main arguments? You really don't come up with anything. They don't argue the case against the soul. They just assume it. A couple of examples of mind over matter that have come to light in recent years. Neuroplasticity is the ability of the mind to shape the brain. Earlier, the central dogma of neuroscience was that neurons of the adult brain don't change anymore. Now, modern neuroscience recognizes that the brain can reorganize. This reorganization is called neuroplasticity throughout life, and not only in the early childhood. He gives examples of Schwartz at UCLA, who is curing people with OCD by having them read a little script, and with functional MRI scanning, they can see the knotted, synapsed areas that fuel the OCD disorder, disentangling and rewiring, and the person becomes cured. The same with phobias. They get people with heavy arachnophobia, where they're constantly, you know, fending off spiders to the point where they can hold a spider in their hand, even touch a tarantula. And meanwhile, they can see in their scans the brain literally changing shape and pattern. Think about that one. So this is mind over matter, isn't it? It's supposed to be, according to the materialist account, it's the brain is all there is. That's what's affecting the mind. But here it's the mind affecting the brain. Yeah, it doesn't hold up very well under this examination. The placebo effect, another example. Here, what you believe, if you believe that you're taking a healing medicine, it has a measurable effect where you are actually healed. It's not that you just believe you're healed. You literally undergo healing. And so that, again, really is a case where your belief is affecting your body, not the brain, and the brain is being affected, but also the body, by what you believe. It's mind over matter. Since the 70s, you have to test any new drug against the placebo effect, because the placebo effect is actually pretty powerful, well established in science. He points out in 2005, the magazine New Scientist put out an article called 13 Things That Make No Sense, Don't Make Sense. Number one on the list was the placebo effect. It only doesn't make sense if you don't believe the mind exists, or if you think it has no power. If you believe in an actual mind, an actual soul, this makes perfect sense. Silver, he talks about this dude, Sylvester Colligan of Beaumont, could barely walk before his 94 knee operation. He was still mobile and free of pain 6 years later. But as he later learned, he was in the control group. He never had surgery. They just put these little cuts on him and put bandages over it. Never did the surgery. And there's a lot of cases like that. Neuroimaging studies have now demonstrated the placebo effect is real, because they can watch the brain changing based on what you believe. It's not simply an artifact of medical record keeping or folklore. Well, all the studies they refer to show that it's not the brain causing the mind, it's the other way around. Well, I'm sorry that I didn't have time to show you a couple of the others that we had to miss. Other arguments in favor of the supernatural, like the ones we've been going over, tie together with this evidence, because once we accept that the supernatural probably exists, then the belief in a soul no longer becomes far out. No longer far-fetched. We studied fulfilled prophecy, Big Bang cosmology, fine-tuning, and the origin of life. All of those lead to the same place that the existence of the soul does. And that is why materialists vigorously fight against the idea of a soul. You don't learn to know someone by studying their body. You know, dissect their brain or look at the matter in there. What do? You get to know how they feel, what they think, you know, what they are passionate about, their beliefs, stuff like that. That's because the material is not the person. It's not me. And dualism is actually true. Does the existence of the soul necessitate God? Yes, it absolutely does. Darwinian evolution can only explain physical alteration. It is mutation of cells within the body. It has nothing to do with the soul. Cannot jump over from the physical to the non-material. That would have to come from some other source, some other non-material spiritual source. All right. Why did God put a soul in you anyway? Why did he create us in his image? It's so that you can be a high order, free choosing moral agent. You can be a lofty being capable of relating to him. You can have direct communion with God because we have this soul. It also enables us to have eternal life. We're not limited to the life of our body. Our life can go on. It does go on. And so we shouldn't miss the punchline here. We have abundant evidence that we do have souls, and that points to the existence of God, having put that soul in there, the Father of spirits, as Hebrews calls him. And it puts to mind Jesus speaking in the book of Revelation and saying, I stand at the door and knock, and if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come into him. It's God's offer, the gospel that that Paul has been writing about in this book of Romans, to get together, to meet you on a spiritual level. You can actually have God come into your life. And it's there for the taking. It's a free gift. We're going to be studying this gift that God wants to give out in the next weeks to come. But there's where this is all headed. And it's headed really well, very good, to know that we can know God personally and be forgiven and guaranteed eternal life with him. And that's probably the best lesson you can draw from the existence of our souls. All right. Well, draw the line there. Let's see what else comes up. Yeah, it would be such a drag if we were turned out to just be physical machines that appear and disappear for a while and no purpose or anything else. And it's really exciting to realize the evidence is powerful that we are high-order beings with a soul and with freedom of thought, exactly like what it seems. It seems like that on the inside, and it's true. We pray, God, that we won't miss the point here and that we won't pass up the opportunity to get to know you, our Creator, the one that bestowed those high-order souls in us. And we pray that you'll be with us and bless us for the study of Romans, which really just moves into that whole area. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.